And good evening. Welcome to another Tuesday night, and this is the Data Hub with Tyron Teichnow. I'm Tyron Teichnow, Director of the Bureau of Statistics and Plans. On tonight's program, we'll have coming up Vera DePosna from the Guam Military Buildup Office, and we'll get an update as to what's happening regarding the buildup and with new partnerships between the Governor of Guam and the military to manage the buildup process. After the top of the hour, after the CBS News, we'll have Director of Agriculture, Chelsea Munyabrek, to talk about the step-up efforts of the conservation officers in the Department of Agriculture to protect our natural resources and marine preserves in our conservation areas, and also to discuss the prospects for a new mobile slaughterhouse, and we'll get into that one. For those of you out there who have not got their vaccinations yet, just a reminder that they're available on a daily basis. There is a vaccination clinic at 9 a.m. tomorrow at the Farmers Co-op, and also throughout the week. And so I encourage you, everyone who has not gotten their vaccinations, to please take advantage of the public offerings to give you a vaccination. We are broadcast live on News Talk K57 and also on 96.5 FM. We're also simulcast on pncguam.com, on at News Talk K57 on Facebook, and on K57.com. We also simulcast on GTA Channel 3 and Docomo Channel 2. And a podcast of tonight's proceedings will be made available in the next couple of days on K57.com. And links to it will be posted on the Bureau of Statistics and Plans, three social media pages, one for the Bureau itself, one for the Coral Reef Initiative, and another one for the Calm Coastal Management Program, which will it's also administered by the Bureau. In future programs, we'll have on Selpa Balta of the Guam Regional Transport Agency to talk about what's happening in GRTA, and particularly their efforts to convert to electric vehicles. And we think that will be very interesting. We'll have also have Dr. Austin Shelton of the Center on Sustainability to talk about the new Guam Green Growth Conservation Corps, which is up and operating over the last couple of weeks, and possibly even have a couple Corps members on the show to talk about their experiences as well. We also will probably have over the next couple of weeks elements of the Bureau of Statistics and Plans to give a preview for the 6th Annual Assembly Planner Symposium, which will be on August 18th, the Dusitani next month. The last Assembly Planner Symposium, the 5th Annual Assembly Planner Symposium, was done on February 20th, 2020, and it was the last big government conference, I think, before restrictions were imposed as a response to the COVID-19 crisis in March of 2020. For those interested in taking a look at what happened in that Assembly Planner Symposium, you can go on YouTube to the Guam Coastal Management Program YouTube page, and there is a recording of all the proceedings from that program. We'll also have later on this month here an update on the work of PBS University and some of the online education materials that are being developed with the Bureau of Statistics and Plans, and also with other partners as well. I also hope to have on in about a month to find out what's new with the museum with Dr. Michael Bavaca. It was an interesting conversation the last time he was on, and the feedback he was getting for his Facebook interviews as well. So that worked out rather well. I think we have online Vera DePosna, and let's see if we can get her online here and to have a discussion about what's happening in the Guam military buildup. And Vera, are you there? Vera, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, now we got you, Vera. Thank you so much for joining us for this segment here. Vera, to start off, why don't you describe what your position is and what agency you work for?
So I am the executive director for the Community Defense Liaison Office, and it's an office within the Office of the Governor.
Yeah, and sometimes colloquially referred to as the Guam Military Buildup Office, and no, that's not the accurate title. One of the things, reasons why I asked Averi to be on the show is that I believe this was last week, we had a very interesting meeting for the a Civilian Military Coordinating Council, which is a collection of Governor Guam officials and military officials to discuss issues related to the coming buildup. And perhaps, Averi, this is like the first. This is like I believe is the first meeting held since COVID hit, which I think complicated matters to have these sort of in-person meetings. Am I correct in that?
Right, right. It was about I would say a little over a year.
Mm. And why don't you sort of probably explain to the listening audience what occurred at that meeting and what are the next steps for this group? And perhaps in your own words, describe what's the purpose of the Civilian Military Coordinating Committee.
Okay, well, the CMCC was created to provide recommendations to Department of Defense to revise current or future construction tempo. And adjusting, you know, the sequencing of construction activities, you know, that would directly influence workforce population levels, mm-hmm. or influence induced population growth, you know, to prevent or reduce significant impacts, you know, to whether it be environment and the environment or socioeconomic. And general, you know, public services.
Mm-hmm.
So since we've been in office, again, you know, you're right, last week we had the second CMCC meeting.
Mm-hmm. The first one was in 2019, then 2020 complicated all our plans.
All of that.
Of that, you know. And so now this is back on track here. And it was, you know, for those of you out there who may get cynical about processes like this, one thing that struck me looking at the meeting is the degree of engagement, which both the outgoing Joint Region Commander, Aaron Manoli, and the incoming Joint Region Commander, I forgot his name. Do you recall what it is?
Nicholson.
They were both there, and also their senior staff here. And to the degree that there was... If energized, but if indeed perhaps even enthusiastic engagement into these issues and working with the civilian leadership on some of these important issues to do the transition to make sure the everyone's interests is served to the maximum extent possible. That was kind of my takeaway. Wasn't that yours, Averi? It was a very high energy meeting.
Yes, it was, and you know, and one of the things that we did in this particular meeting was that the working group then took some time after the formal meeting, you know, between the military and our GovGuam cabinet members to discuss.
Led by Governor Leon Goro herself.
Details,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. To discuss specific details about the buildup and some of the challenges that we're having. And it was certainly a very, as you said, you know, very productive, very transparent, and certainly a very frank meeting regarding the buildup and what's to come, right? And the peak year that we'll see just so much activity. And not that we're seeing a lot, you know, that we're not seeing a lot right now, because we are. There is a lot of work going on. But we anticipate the peak coming up, upon us very soon.
Yeah. So maybe perhaps share with the listening audience. What are the sort of issues that came up in the CMC meeting or in the subsequent working group meeting? Just to give them a sense as to what are the issues that are grappled with by this group.
You know, right now one of the biggest issues is. You know, GovGuam's capacity to handle the increased workload, so you've got directly probably being impacted right now in terms of work for the government of Guam in processing of the construction would be, you know, your the environmental team, Guam Environmental Protection Agency, mm-hmm. Who is responsible, right, for enforcing local and federal environmental laws, they also issue permits. And then you have the SHPO's office who...
The State Historic Preservation Office, just for Parks and Recreation, that is dealing with historic
and cultural issues and processes. And then you have the Department of Labor, who is dealing with the increase in H-2B processing, you know, for not just the military construction, but also, you know, the growing infrastructure projects outside the fence.
Isn't one of the concerns regarding that whole alien labor certification process is that under the National Defense Authorization Act, there is an exemption from the normal restrictions on the certification by the federal government. So this labor is available for federal military projects, but not necessarily for private sector civilian projects. And in fact, it's one of the issues that is brought up is that even the available labor force here that tends to be absorbed by these military construction contracts, and this sort of thing is subject to hyperbole, but it's sort of stifled a good part of private sector construction activity because there's a lack of labor. And I've heard that's sort of one of the issues that we've had to contend with, but or is that above the level of this group to actually address?
Well, in this particular meeting, I don't think that was something that was brought up. Although I do have to say that, you know, outside of this CMCC meeting, there is direct engagement between Department of Labor and, let's say, NAFAC, Marianas, who oversees, you know, military construction. So there's ongoing discussions between our government of Guam agencies on a day-to-day basis. So, but I have heard from, you know, many of our construction companies, right, the challenges that they're having. We have a project that we oversee, as you probably know, the Cultural Repository.
And so many
of these construction contractors are doing, especially the small ones, are doing both military and civilian construction work, right? So, you know, as you said, the shortage in manpower certainly makes it very challenging for these construction companies. And, you know, and I know that the Guam Contractors Association and, the you know, their training arm with Bert Johnson still training as much as possible. But when you're looking at skilled labor, right, you're looking at most of them being the H-2B. I think, you know, everybody's fully aware of that, and that's where the challenges are. And so with respect to processing of H-2B and that the National Defense Authorization Act, you know, the step that was added to that process was the ability for the Joint Region Commander, which would be now Admiral Nicholson, to then, you know, certify that, you know, an infrastructure or construction project outside of the base is in line with the military buildup, right, and growth. And so we've been able to get, I believe, most of those, if not all of those projects so far, approved. But I think that you know, the full exemption is still yet to be to be pursued, it has been pursued, but has not been
fully resolved yet.
Cleared by U.S. Immigration, right? So that's certainly something that we'll bring up. But again, the Joint Region Commander has been able to, you know, approve a bakery off base to be built, you know, and a civilian infrastructure project. To link it to the buildup, right? So that's how this that process has been going. Now, if I don't think it has changed, and so I would probably defer to Dave Delasola to see if he has an update. But I have not seen the NDAA change yet, nor have I seen any policy changes that put in that restriction.
Right. And David Delasola from the Department of Labor and is looking closely with the governor's office. There have been a number of recent meetings about this, and it's probably high on the governor's agenda when she goes to Washington, as you expect to do sometime in late July. Anyone wishing to join the conversation, by the way, you can call in at 477-5757. That's 477-5757. We are broadcast live on News Talk KV7 and 96.5 FM. Vera, before we go to return to the subject of the CMCC, you touched on one thing that I also want to highlight that people don't entirely appreciate, and that your office is really directly involved in the administration of a number of important grants. You just mentioned the $12 million for the Culture Depository at the University of Guam. But I also believe you're, through AA funding and through your office there, it's involvement in the planned Guam Medical Park and scoping up the general overall planning process. Is that do I have that one right? It's about $1.7 million in OEA funding.
Yes.
And so I just wanted to just to briefly touch on those things and invite you for any comments you have on this also the other projects, so people get a more fuller sense as to what your office does besides, you know, get involved in these important discussions with Joint Region and military officials here. Are there any other projects outstanding currently with OEA funding that you're familiar with at this point?
Right now, we are waiting for, and it's been approved in Congress and funded for 2021. And so we are waiting for the award of the construction for the public health laboratory, biosafety level 2/3. So it's a very sophisticated laboratory. And that is a $32 million project.
Is that include the environmental health building, that $32
million? It's a biosafety lab capable of, capable of doing testing locally. Mm-hmm. So as you're probably aware, some of these infectious diseases, that require specialized kind of testing have to be flown out to Hawaii, right? And I think we had to deal with that at the onset of COVID-19, and I'm not sure if it was the dengue as well that needed
it's
to
a
go
matter
off,
of
right?
Getting
but
the
this
testing
laboratory will provide the capability to test locally.
Right. And cut the lag time there. So am I correct? So the funding amount is $27 million and it's been approved by Congress and you're waiting for, I guess, what, the notice of award? Or
yes,
is that where we're out of this?
It's $32 million.
Okay.
We are working on the grant conditions and working with the Arts and Augustine and, of course, Vince Ariola from DPW, who will manage the construction piece. So we're working closely on trying to finalize the grant, and we should be seeing something fairly soon. It has to be awarded by September 30.
So
there's a tight timeline to get it to Guam so that we can start the process.
Right. Okay. And we have also a caller on the line, Vera. John, you have a question for Vera Tapasna?
Yeah. Hey, good evening, Vera. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good. Hey, so I just wanted to ask, is your office, how influential are you with helping the veterans in getting what we need out here as far as, you know, like the, like they were talking about earlier the week, veterans hospital maybe? Mm-hmm. And does your office have any engagement at all in the development of a possible VA hospital or something?
Well, only to the extent that if there is any, obviously the veterans budget bill, right, is, you know, it is synced and it intersects with the Department of Defense, right, because they're all, you know, veterans, right? So to the extent that, there would be engagement by DOD to do any kind of planning on behalf of the Veterans Administration to support the governor, then yes, our office would be involved to that extent.
And Vera, Carla, let me just also point out that, as we touched on earlier, through Vera's office, there's $1.7 million being invested in the upcoming Guam Medical Park, which the governor plans to include in not only a new hospital, but with a specific provision for veterans. So she's, although it's not on a policy basis, but it is on a support basis that Vera's office involved in this one. Does that answer your question? Would you have any other questions?
Yeah, that works. Thank you.
All right, John, thanks so much for your call. Please feel free to call in any time. And now we have to cut that off. So we can talk. This is what I refer to repeatedly as the wonders of live radio, Vera. So anyway, thanks, Vera. It's nice to get a phone call to touch on this issue. But anyway, let's go back to the CMCC. They've had this meeting after a year's hiatus due to COVID-19 disrupting everybody's plans. And so what are the next steps here? I mean, what's sort of on the agenda for future meetings and for the associated working group?
So what we're working on following that meeting is a more more consistent schedule for meeting with the council. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking at quarterly meetings given the activity that is going on now and what's expected in the future. So we're planning on quarterly meetings. Mm-hmm. We're looking at expanding the CMCC structure or procedure, if you will, to cover additional topics of concern. Mm-hmm. that may be brought up by the governor's team, right? And mm-hmm. even DOD, for that
right,
matter.
Right, it's meant to generate that two-way communication.
Something that we're looking forward to, to doing, right, is expanding beyond and talking about, other issues that are maybe not necessarily directly related to construction, but certainly deals with Department of Defense and some of the activities and the partnership. So that's something that we're looking forward to. We're taking a look at the CMCC charter and whether or not it requires an amendment. We hope not, because then it'll just have to go through a whole slew. So, of legal authorities and reviews, and we know DOD. It has to go to a series of legal review in Hawaii and mm-hmm. I would say DC, because it was created as a result of the record of decision and the supplemental environmental impact statement in 2015. So, there's some tie to the legalities of it, but that's something the lawyers will hash out. But we're excited that they were open to it. The governor, proposed that, and so the JRM commander at the time, we had both Admiral Minoni, who was outgoing, and Nicholson mm-hmm. incoming, who both agreed that it would really serve us well as a community to be able to cover other issues that we're facing.
Listen, Vera, we have another caller who may doesn't have a question, but he wants to offer congratulatory remarks to you. So, Joe, are you on the line? Joe?
Hi, Vera. This is Joseph Cameron. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. How are you?
Great, great. I just wanted to just offer a word of congratulatory to you and your work. I was, at the time, President Shamor Fair some years ago, and, of course, I came to the table on most of those meetings in reference to the programmatic agreement and how the military buildup impacts our community on a regular basis. And I have to say that those meetings were consistently in a very positive way, and I'm seeing that you're doing likewise. And I just want to congratulate you for your esprit de corps, and most especially the manner in which you express the information that's necessary to the listening audience. Thank you so much for that.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you.
And Joe, thank you. Actually, I think, I don't know if you intend this now, but this is a double gift. Not only you're calling your congratulations to Vera, but I'm pleased as punch to find out that you're part of the audience for the Data Hub. So, you know.
That'll have a great interest in our community.
Yes, and you know, so, but. Well, excuse me if I make it all about me, but you know. But Joe, to be honest, Joe, to you and I, I'm always pleasantly surprised when I find out people are listening to this program on a Tuesday night. So, you know, there is. Thanks for calling in, Joe. Okay.
Yeah, take care of you both.
Okay, Joe. That's Joseph Cameron, former president of the Department of Tomorrow Affairs. So, you know, Vera, one of the things that comes up. The departing music of callers to get off the line. So, anyway, one of the things that we didn't have time to get to, but probably in a future program, is the sort of quarterly reports, presentations made by the officer in charge of the OICC for the Marine Corps, and they were briefing the broad array of ongoing military construction projects, and, you know, including three bachelor enlisted quarters, each housing DF and and each housing 600 Marines and community building equipment, washdown area facilities, various facilities such as horseshoe pits, volleyballs, basketball courts, and pavilions. There's $36.2 million contract for the main and commercial gates. There's a $54 million ongoing contract for the administration section. Then there is a number of other, including a warehouse and central issue facility. This is a $76 million contract. It's just the award in just this year for a completion date of February 2024, which it controls a single-story, low-bay distribution warehouse to support supply, food service, and medical logistics detachments, and constructs a low-rise central issue facility with individual and unit issue facilities and a chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear equipment storage area. Well, anyway, just, you know, all these interesting stuff you get to read when these throw presentations. But they do this, they make this presentation about once a quarter, don't they, Vera?
Yes, pretty much. And you know, they're doing it with some of the organizations, you know, Guam Contractors, Guam Chamber. But certainly the governor or the lieutenant governor, whenever they require an update, they are, you know, they are always more than willing to provide an update to us. And normally what we track, because, as you know, they get the annual budget. So we know, you know, what that annual budget looks like. But what's also important is the work in, you know, work in place, right? What's currently happening. Or, you know, in terms of expenditures for the current year. And then, of course, looking at what's planned, and then you put that all together and you start to see the growth, right, in terms of dollar value and even work itself, right? Mm-hmm. So that does, you know, I mean, they usually present quarterly to different organizations, but it is available, an update is available to the governor and our team, and anytime we request it, for sure.
Well, that's good to know. Tell you what, very near you're hitting the top of the hour to hard news break for the 7 o'clock CBS Radio News. But Vera Tapasa, thank you so much for joining the Data Hub, and I hope to have you back on maybe the next quarter in the next CMCC meeting here. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Okay.
Sounds good. So thank you so much, Tyrone, and have a good night. And,
same to you.
Good luck on your show tonight.
Well, here we go. Okay, now we're just going to pause at 7 o'clock for the CBS Radio News. Thank you. good evening. It's Tuesday night and time for another edition of the Data Hub with Tyron Titano. I'm Tyron Titano, Director of Bureau of Statistics and Plan. In the first segment, we had Vera DePosna discussing about current issues regarding the Guam military buildup. And coming up is Chelsea Munyabrek, Director of the Department of Agriculture. And we're going to talk about the work of her conservation offices and also touch on other agriculture-related issues, including initiative to move forward with a mobile animal slaughterhouse in order to start a meat processing industry. I asked Chelsea to be on the program because I got in my emails a number of press releases over the last month or so from the Department of Agriculture. The first one I saw was on May 11, 2021, and it read, the Department of Agriculture Law Enforcement Section Conservation Officers executed an arrest of five individuals on Monday, April 19th, 2021. While on patrol, conservation officers, along with CV Corps, or Conservation Reserve Officers, observed a vessel in the Achang Ri Flat Marine Preserve area. At approximately 12:43 a.m., five individuals were arrested for illegal fishing. Conservation officers confiscated the following: one truck, one boat trailer, one boat, two extra large coolers, one small cooler, and one plastic container, and seven plastic bags containing suspected clam meat, one octopus, one squid, two impaled lobsters, 129 assorted reef fish, and numerous miscellaneous fishing gear and equipment. And they have a list of who was arrested and with pictures of the stuff that was taken. And Department of Agriculture Director Chelsea Munyabrek states, as your conservation office gains increasing support from the Leongro Tonoro administration and from senators in the 36th legislature, they become more effective and are able to remain vigilant in their efforts to protect our preserves. Conservation officers patrol the marine preserve areas to protect our natural resources for us all. And then on June 2nd, I read this press release, also from the Department of Agriculture. It reads, June 2nd, 2021, Manila, Guam. Conservation officers from the Law Enforcement Section, Department of Agriculture, arrested two individuals at Northwest Field Area, Anniston Air Force Base. On May 25th, 2021, conservation officers received a call from Anderson Air Force Base, 36 Security Forces, reporting suspected illegal hunting activity at the Northwest Field Area, Anderson Air Force Base. Conservation officers met up with Anderson Air Force Base 36 Security Force officers accompanied by military working dog teams and conducted joint surveillance of the area. Consequently, conservation officers, along with the 36 Security Force officers and K-9 teams, apprehended two male individuals. And that's who was arrested. Items seized and confiscated included a Mitsubishi Lancer sedan, 22 caliber ammunition, one hunting knife, two duffel bags. Pictures of the items were attached to the press release. Conservation officers patrol territorial and marine coast areas to protect our natural resources for us all. So and that press release is shown June 2nd. On June 17th, Dateline, June 17, 2021, Manila, Guam. The Department of Agriculture, Law Enforcement Section Conservation Officers executed an arrest of two individuals on June 12, 2021, upon receiving a call reporting possible illegal spearfishing. Conservation officers conducted a check at the Petey Bomb Hole Marine Preserve area at approximately 10:41 p.m. Two individuals were arrested for illegal fishing in the PDM Marine Preserve area. Conservation officers confiscated a total of 58 assorted reef fish, three lobster, two impaled and undersized, as well as one female containing eggs and miscellaneous fishing paraphernalia. Conservation officers patrol the Marine Preserve areas to protect natural resources for us all. And then we got this press release on June 18th. The Department of Agriculture, Law Enforcement Section, Conservation Officers executed an arrest of three individuals. On June 15, 2021, conservation received information from Anniston Air Force Base, again Anniston Air Force Base, 36th Security Force, who executed a traffic stop of a vehicle along Route 3A GIGO. Three individuals were detained for suspicion of illegal hunting. At approximately 10:10 p.m., three individuals were arrested for protection of wild animal and use of artificial light prohibited. Conservation officers confiscated two shotguns and a vehicle along with miscellaneous hunting paraphernalia. Conservation officers patrolled the terrestrial and marine coastal areas to protect natural resources for us all. And leading the Department of Agriculture is Chelsea Munyabrek, who is on the line. Chelsea, are you there?
Hello.
Chelsea.
Hi, Tyrone.
I started off by reading your greatest hits over the last month, and one reason why I've asked you on the program or other subject, but also I wanted to give you a chance to share with the public what is very clearly a stepped up effort by the conservation officers of the Department of Agriculture to enforce the rules and regulations that are necessary to protect our natural resources, not only for the enjoyment of the community, but for the benefit of future generation. I also have on the other line a Richard Radaggio. Is that with your department, Chelsea?
Absolutely. He's okay. Our conservation lieutenant.
So, Richard, can you see if we can get Richard on the line? Richard, are you there? Richard? I'm sorry, can we get Richard Radaggio on the line? I think they're still working out in the booth. Yes. Anyway, well, let's before while we get to the technical difficulties of getting him on the line, Joseph, why don't you explain what the current operation you have for conservation officers? And let's see, Richard, are you on the line? Richard, are you with us?
Yeah.
Okay, Richard.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Oh, and did we lose Chelsea when you wrecked the same? I think we lost your boss in the process, Richard. But I tell you what, Chelsea, I'm sure we'll call back. Why don't you identify yourself, Richard, and what your position is over the Department of Agriculture?
I'm Richard M. Radaggio, and I'm the conservation lieutenant. The officer in charge for the law enforcement section, conservation officers.
I think I've lost Richard as well. So I've okay. Well, let's see. Is Chelsea on the line? So Chelsea, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Chelsea, I think you've been on my program before, where I describe moments like this as the wonderful world of live radio. Okay. So anyway, I think Richard is calling back the other line. So while we're waiting to do it, why don't you again? I let off with you. Why don't you describe what's happening with our conservation officers and explain this increased tempo of enforcement of the rules and regulations?
Hello,
Richard, you're there.
Yes.
Okay.
I got cut off, and I'm getting back on.
And guess what? You got back on just in time for us to lose Chelsea again. So, Richard, I tell you what, how many conservations officers are there right now?
We have six. We just, one of our conservation sergeant just retired this Friday.
Wow. Thank you. Just see if we can get her on the line, Chelsea online. Well, I'll tell you, Richard, you guys have been a busy bunch. Now, in addition, I noted that you were joined in these efforts here by conservation reserve officers. Huh. Let's see now. Okay, let's see if we can, okay, so who do I have on the, so a passive dial tone, oh, I have no one on the line, fantastic. So folks, as we wait for a very chaste patient, Chelsea Munyabarek and Richard Dayu to get on the line, and let's see,
what, back.
Richard, there we go. Now, you also are your force of six conservation officers are augmented by reserve conservation officers.
Yes.
Is that not the case? Why don't you describe their program and how many reserve conservation officers are there?
Well, we got it through a grant last year. Ms. Lola Leon Guerrero from BSB, she was very crucial in helping us get it through. It started out with
I'm so glad you mentioned that. You know what I do, don't you?
Yes.
Okay, so, you know.
She does deserve credit because she's been guiding me, mentoring me on this, the grant and the CIFCOR program.
Yeah, one of the luckiest things, fortunately, I have is that the governor appointed me to head an agency filled with very competent and dedicated professionals. And yes, by all means, single Lola. She's one of the chief planner of the bureau and one of the cornerstones of our operation. But continue. You got a grant to fund a conservation officer reserve program, right?
Yes, we have 10 right now. Actively, we have 7 to 8 that are active right now. There's a few that because they got picked, they went on the military orders,
right?
And then one. On their permanent government job, they got switched out to another position. So they are having some issues to make their 42 hours. But all in all, the 6 or 7 that we have that are consistent are very, very strong in their support and their motivation with the program.
So, Chelsea, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, let's see how long this lasts. But anyway, Richard has done a very good job of painting the pictures to what the conservation offices work for, which is about six right now, and a number of reserve conservations. As the director who has the job to pull all this together, what does this mean for the future of the current conservation officer force and moving forward?
What's your outlook? Well, we've made just structured effort to do with what we can, because of course there are not nearly enough conservation officers. Mm-hmm. But we put all of our, both the deputy and I, put every opportunity we had, every resource we had behind supporting them and trying to just ensure that they knew that they were supported. If just as long as they could do their job, we would be back there trying to get more resources for them. And I think all of these arrests are just a manifestation of this administration making a concerted effort to support the conservation officers. And now we're looking forward to even more personnel for the section that absolutely needs it.
And I assume this section is kind of sort of a lean organization, and not much equipment is attached to it at this point, though, right? I get that sense of it.
They definitely need resources in the form of equipment, and just upgrading their equipment, updating their equipment, and improving it. They just recently got new computers this year. They never had a phone line. They just got phone lines in their office this year.
Well, I'm afraid, Chelsea, I have to cop to that. Well, that was a leading question, because in case my staff has not informed you, and folks, just so you understand how this works here, one of the many responsibilities of the Bureau of Statistics and Plans that people aren't entirely familiar with is that we manage a number of grants from the U.S. Department of Justice to support law enforcement and to get them resources needed for any number of things here. And because of one grant we had, the Bureau was able to secure a new patrol vehicle, a Tahoe SUV, for your conservation officers. And I've been informed today that it is on island, and they're going through
That's
the process
awesome.
Of registration and decals, and should be made available by sometime next week. So,
Such wonderful news.
So, you know, and I think I couldn't have a more appropriate time, as your conservation officers have done some sterling work. And going out through, in God, all hours of the night, for Christ's sakes, and in order to protect our natural resources, and as you know, Chelsea, the governor is very much interested in this program, as is the lieutenant governor, and every effort will be devoted to give your correction officers all the resources necessary to do this very important job. So. This is by the way, the second commercial with the Bureau of Statistics and Plans. In case you caught the first one, Richard was very kind enough to outline the fine work of the chief planner of the Bureau, Lola Leongoro, in securing the grant to support the conservation.
Oh, I am a true Lola Leongoro fan. I am definitely a fangirl.
Yes, as are we all. Just before we move any further, we have Jay Gutierrez on the line. Let's see if this works, okay? Jay? Okay, I think the booth I had to sort of catch the attention of the people in the booth to see if they can get Jay Gutierrez in line, because he's posted on my screen, and yet, you know, it's, well, we'll go back to Jay when I get the attention of the people in the booth on this. Anyway, so this is, you know, I've read like four press releases in basically almost as many weeks. This speaks to a very serious and concerted effort and also concerning a lot of the stuff happens at night by your department to enforce the rules and regulations there. Is there, and I'm sure this is part of a larger strategy. And Chelsea, I'm just going to give you some time to sort of share with the audience your outlook and your goals for this process here, and what you hope to achieve with the necessary support, of course.
Well, one of the first things I told each of the sections of the agency and the conservation officers were no exception, was that I didn't understand the scope of the work that the agency covered. I mean, just walking into that agency, I was completely taken aback by just how much responsibility every section of that agency has and what it means to our community. And if I, as someone who absolutely loves natural resources and mm-hmm. loves the idea of farming and loved engaging in farming and loved, my friends used to joke that I never knew what I wanted to be because I wanted to be a farmer, I wanted to be a marine biologist, I wanted to do all of this stuff, but I have a natural love for all of these things, and I didn't understand just how much is done at the agency, then there's no way that the average person in the community would understand. So the very first thing that we talked about doing was making sure I understand the work that they did so that we could share that with the community and so that the community would understand everything that they did. And these press releases are no... I mean, that's the only thing that's new. The level of work and professionalism that our conservation officers demonstrate every single day has always been there. They've always been doing the work, but now we're just showcasing it and making sure the community understands the work that they do, and we're supporting it by making sure that people who offend or break the law know that that's what they were doing and that's why they were arrested, and to try and prevent those same situations, we're also increasing and stepping up our outreach to make sure that the community is aware of what they should and shouldn't be doing in certain areas. We're bringing everything in from, like, the computers that I talked about. We're increasing their social media presence. We're increasing their press releases that go out. I'm bringing them on to interviews. I don't know that Richard ever really had to do very many interviews before, but this will be, the second one this week. Because it's not my work. I just get to be the person that talks about them. I want them to be there talking about the work that they do. So that the community sees them more and recognizes the people who are doing all of this work that make our island so beautiful.
Well, well said, Chelsea. Now, Chelsea, we're going to try and do something very dangerous now. I'm going to try and keep you and Richard on the line and let in Jay Gutierrez as a caller. No? Line? Okay. Whoever... Is there...
So we can only have up to two callers at once.
Oh, my God.
Sorry about that, boss.
Oh, my God. Can you put Richard on hold so we don't lose him? Can you do
that?
He's still on. Okay, good. But I want to get Jay on the line to talk to Chelsea since he called in.
He's on the line, I believe.
Yeah, I know. But so Jay, are you there?
If I add this, they're going to drop one call.
Well, then drop Richard. Can you put Richard on hold? Put Richard on hold. And then instead of cutting him off. And then see if you can get Jay on the line with Chelsea. Let's do that, okay? Okay, see how dangerous live radio is, Chelsea? On top of this, some of the stuff is sort of live stream and simulcast. Okay, so Jay, are you there? No, Jay is still on hold. Can you put Richard on hold and put Jay on the line? Do I have... Chelsea, you there? Richard, you there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so we lost Chelsea, but you're there. And online is Jay Gutierrez. Jay, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Very good. Excuse the technical difficulties and the slight delay, but did you have a question for the people from the Department of Agriculture?
Oh, no. I'm with the Department of Agriculture.
You're with the Department of Agriculture. Oh, my gosh. So, Jay, what do you do with the Department of Agriculture?
I'm the chief of the Division of Aquatic and Wildlife Resources.
I thought the name looked familiar, but I didn't realize we were going to have three people on. As you can tell, Jay, we can only accommodate two at one time. You know, so as a group, the only guy can in addition to, fortunately, they resolved the issues of your computer access recently. Here, we still have some technical issues here to resolve. But anyway, Jay. Welcome to the conversation. Is there anything you'd like to add that your boss, Chelsea, and your colleague, Richard, have not already added so far?
For the Division of Aquatic and Wildlife Resources, we're actually, the new section that we're creating is technical, well, not really new, but we're trying to beef it up, build it up, technical guidance section.
Mm-hmm.
We review a lot of the developmental permits, such as building permits, clearing, grading permits,
right.
By conditions to these permits. And one of the things that we're trying to do is at, on an administrative level, is trying to have the staff starting to go out and monitor any violations that occur with the conditions that we place on these permits in regards to like endangered species. So that would require some little bit of local funding, mm-hmm. but we're trying to move in that direction for DAR and trying to do that. That's one of the things I wanted to mention.
Okay, great. Jay, I'm going to try and get your boss back on the line, but as a consequence, I may have to lose you. But so thanks for calling in, and let's see if we can get Chelsea and Richard back on the line.
Okay.
So, Chelsea, are you there? Richard, you're there with us, right?
Yes, sir.
And Chelsea, are you with us now?
Yes.
Okay. I've had to let go of your colleague, Jay Gutierrez. I looked at the name, but I figured it couldn't be that Jay Gutierrez, but apparently it is. So he's able to bring us up to speed on the technical changes in his section here. But we're back to you and your stalwart conservation officer. So getting back to this here, let's properly just to expand the context here for the listening audience. What is actually threatened to the Marine Preserve and these conservation efforts by these activities, which you're Richard and his colleagues as conservation officers are trying to bring a halt to, not only in their enforcing the law, but the deterrence factor. What is actually threatened here with this activity, this illegal activity?
Well, the initial intent of the Marine Preserves was to serve as sort of a, I guess almost like an incubator. It's a place where our reef fish come, they lay their eggs, they feed off of the like the algae and plant growth that proliferate on our coral reefs. So it's like a mutually beneficial relationship. You have these beautiful corals that are rare, and in some cases listed in their own, but not really. But we have over 400 different species of coral in Guam's waters. So they're beautiful, they're an attraction for our tourists, and then they bring the reef fish, mm-hmm. which our people also feed on and eat as part of our cultural practices and food security.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where they come and they lay their eggs, and they need to get to a certain size to do that. But because of overfishing and increase in population and the pressure on the reef, we started to lose our fish population.
Right.
So the intention of the preserves was to create habitat that is safe for these fish to come and breed and multiply, and then they would swim out of the preserve, and that's when you could fish them or when they could be caught. It also serves as an area to protect the coral
mm-hmm.
That live in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
Tuman is a preserve because of that, the reef flat, the fish that proliferate in that area, but also because it's a tourist attraction site, which brings in millions of dollars to the island every year, with the exception of last year and perhaps this year.
But there
are sites located around other parts of the island where the preserve serve the same function. As an example, Sasa Bay is a no-take site where you can't even catch fish in that area or disturb or cause any sort of take is considered any sort of like harassment or disturbance to the sea life in that area. And then what they found is that it serves as a breeding site for, I want to say, is it baby hammerhead sharks that they found in some of the waters. They found some of the genetics for the sharks in the waters of Sasa Bay. So each different preserve has a unique characteristic to it, but they all essentially serve as the same function to help our reef fish increase their biomass around the island.
And since some of the activities of your correction officers have been dealing with hunting and protection of wild animals, what is threatened by those sort of activities to our resources?
Well, it's more about safety for the hunting activities.
Mm-hmm.
Richard did a great example of explaining this the other day, where he talked about people who go hunting at night and using the lights. Richard, did you want to maybe elaborate on that a little bit?
Oh, yes, sir. It's first and foremost is mainly about safety.
Mm-hmm.
When you do hunt at night, or they do go illegal hunting at night, there is a very non-safety factor to it. In my career here, I think I've been about around 5 to 7 negligent homicides that was attributed to illegal hunting at night. Second is, and I don't want to get too, but in any case, a lot of the illegal hunting and poaching, not a lot, but a majority of it, a high percentage, does involve the illicit drug trade. So that's one of the things that we try to come in and clamp down a little bit with this type of enforcement.
And indeed, in one of the news releases, although I didn't read out those references, one of the people arrested was arrested for possession of a controlled substance.
Yes, and unfortunately, because of that disease of the drugs here, and I'm not going to be judgmental, but it is part of the issue, and we come into it a lot. In fact, one of our bigger cases about a year and a half, 2 years ago in the Marble Cave area, that was close to over 1.2 million total confiscation. So that there's two factors that I try to focus on. Is one is the safety, right, and the two, because it does involve the drug trade here in Guam.
You know, Richard, perhaps you explained something else to me. In one of the news release, it talked about individuals being arrested not only for protection of wildlife, but use of artificial light prohibited.
Correct.
What does that mean?
Okay, it's in Chapter 63, 63125, use of artificial light prohibited. Basically, that's just like a flashlight, a handheld flashlight, a spotlight, a headlamp, even your car vehicle. I've had it in my experience, Route 3A, that's over at Rutidian, right? They'll go back and forth, left and right, with using their headlights. So basically, because the deer, you've heard that terminology or that phrase.
Deer caught in the headlights.
Headlights, and that deer in the headlights, because they will stand still. And just because they're curious, and what's that light, and get shot.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you're just not supposed, because it's not hunting per se for sport, right? Mm-hmm. You're poaching,
mm-hmm.
And one of the key factors again to that is that although the deer, of course, is technically is an invasive species, right? It is an asset of Guam, because at DAR. Right, and the Department of Agriculture, we do issue out a hunting license, right, and then we do issue out, not this time around because of COVID, but we do issue out hunting tags. So then in itself, that is an asset. It's a resource for the government of Guam, for the island of Guam. So it's a fair shake, right, for those that do go out and do the right thing and get their hunting license and do hunt at the right time of the day during the hunting seasons. So it's just the fairness of them having to pay, all right, for that resource. Because I understand with the general public when they say sustenance and we need to put deer on the table, food. I understand that to a certain degree, but in reality, we all know, right, that it's a delicacy when we have it over in the fiesta tables and everything. But
I've only had Bonato who had naturally died of heart attacks, and then were found. So, just for the record, but go ahead.
So anyway, so basically, it's the use of artificial light is you're illegally hunting at night, and you're using a form of artificial light. Would that be a handheld flashlight, a headlamp, a spotlight, or even your vehicle lights at night?
Okay, great. So, Chelsea, I did want to talk to you about. About the slaughterhouse and a couple of other issues. Is there anything that you and Richard and perhaps Jay want to add to on the discussion about the fine work of your conservation hours and the stepped up tempo of enforcement? One of the things that has always come up about as to why these regulations are not as enforced as strictly as they used to is because of negative feedback and political unrest or something because of this is done. But I've in my experience over the last month, I think the stepped up enforcement by your department has actually come as a great satisfaction to people that the someone is out there making sure the rules are followed and to preserve the quality of life for all our people and for future generations. Have you gotten any criticism for all this massive activity over the last month or so?
Absolutely not. I think what the conservation officers and even to some extent our biologists in DAR have found is that the people who once stood opposed to the work that they do now stand in support and wanting more enforcement because they started to see the same picture that our biologists were painting, that our resources were being challenged and that there were people who used them and still had wanton waste, or they used them and just exacerbated the resources beyond what they could handle. So then they were like pleading for more enforcement. And now that we're able to support our officers and work on getting more personnel, work on getting more equipment, mm-hmm. work on getting more supplies, and they're seeing the increase in enforcement, everyone is happy about it.
Ah, okay. Well, I tell you what, Chelsea, with your permission, when we get into the subject matters, I'm going to let go Richard and Jake Gutierrez, who is still on hold, while we talk about the slaughterhouse. And that will also allow me to do yet another risky thing, which is invite callers to call in. You know, I did not want to do when we had the fragile two or three people online. But is that okay with you, Chelsea?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, so Jay Gutierrez, Richard, you know, and Richard Radagiu, thank you so much for being part of the Data Hub. We are live on News Talk K57 and 96.5 FM. If anyone wants to join the conversation in the last 20 minutes of the segment, you can call at 477-5757, 477-5757. So, Chelsea, you know, there's been some public discussion recently here about the issues of a slaughterhouse. Which to me, in a way, sort of, in one way, it doesn't surprise me because there's always been an interest in it. But the other one that surprised me is if this is something new. The discussion for slaughterhouse, oh my God, I remember writing political materials on this subject in the 90s. You know, for this thing, you know, and all the benefits of having a slaughterhouse, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. But the real problem that has held us back from actually having a slaughterhouse, historically, though, Chelsea, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the lack of having on-site USDA inspectors.
Yeah.
And I recall is when I was writing these platforms in the 90s that referred to the slaughterhouse, one of the big frustrating factors was that there was a USDA inspector in Saipan, but none on Guam. But that situation has changed recently, has it not?
Yes, it has, absolutely. We now have, I believe there are three inspectors on Guam, mm-hmm. USDA inspectors.
And that has cleared the way for your department to move forward in initiatives to actually bring into reality a slaughterhouse. Is that a fair assessment?
It is. But it's funny, it reminds me of a scene from a movie that I was cracking up where the friend was making fun of the family, saying, "You guys always have one of two things. You have one thing, like if you have Kool-Aid but no sugar, mm-hmm. or you have cereal but no milk." Mm-hmm. So initially in the 90s, they had the land and the funding, but no USDA inspectors. And now we have the USDA inspectors, and we have to go locate a site and obtain the funding.
Well,
we've been making progress on both fronts.
Right, but also you're exploring the option of a mobile slaughterhouse, have you not?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that I love learning about the most when I was learning about meat processing, was the fact that for smaller farms, which fit a lot of the farm sizes on Guam, the most efficient slaughtering process was out of a mobile truck. And I was learning about this because I was learning about how to process my chickens that we raised for eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I came into this job, I thought this is perfect because most of our farms are not hundreds of acres with thousands of head of anything. So we would fit the size of, you know, for a mobile slaughterhouse. And I found that we could bring one on island for roughly about $400,000, and it would be completely outfitted to process both cattle and poultry, and it would come with everything that was necessary to have it be USDA approved. Mm-hmm. So it would be a really, like, the Cadillac version of mobile slaughterhouses. mobile slaughter vehicles.
And isn't one advantage of the mobile slaughterhouse, as opposed to siting a permanent slaughterhouse, is that you avoid the sort of NIMBY factor, and it's not in my backyard. When you have to erect a slaughterhouse, you have to consider community response to having that facility there permanently for perhaps a generations. And with a mobile slaughterhouse, maybe just an afternoon in the parking lot, you know.
It provides a comfort to a convenient resource for farmers because, I mean, you think about cattle ranchers in the States, and what's interesting enough is that there used to be slaughterhouses in several locations around the state, mm-hmm. but then they began consolidating them, and it made it harder and harder for cattle ranchers to move their livestock. And then you see all these several truckloads of vehicles that were moving cattle because they were trying to get them to the slaughter facility. And so for Guam farmers or ranchers or livestock raisers, they would have to purchase trailers, large trucks, just to be able to move their livestock to where we would need it to be there. I mean, can you imagine raising your cattle in Molesto or in Alahan
right.
and then having to drive up to Jigo every week or every month to process your meat? And
it's not as if you can herd them along the road.
The refrigeration and what you'd have to do for all of that.
And it's not as if you can do like a cattle drive along the road from Umatic to get them up the hill, you know, and you'd have to actually, you know, car them up there in vehicles almost one or two at a time, which is not practical. So the estimated cost for a mobile slaughterhouse is about $400,000, you say?
Well, it's about $354,000, and mm-hmm. I was just tacking on an additional for whatever shipping and customs taxes we would need to pay on it. But the vehicle itself, a really gorgeous model that I saw, was about $354,000. And it came with all the sanitation issues addressed. It would pass every USDA inspection that was necessary. And then the USDA inspectors would be here, or already here. And in our conversations with them, I found that a farmer would not have to pay to have them on site as long as they were processing like chickens or cows. They would only have to pay a fee if they were processing deer, which would be considered an exotic animal.
Right, right. Well, you know, perhaps the senators of the 36th Guam Legislature that you were gracious enough to identify in your news releases and how important their support for conservation officers, maybe they might be persuaded in the upcoming FY22 budget to include funding for the slaughterhouse and sort of close the circle here, because you know I've had conversations about the last couple of days, and I've sort of had to remind people that the idea of the slaughterhouse is not new, and the drawback to doing it is not because there weren't people around to do it, or you needed a land to do it, because you could get the mobile slaughterhouse to do it, or you needed some pasture land, or you needed some of this. No, it was because of the lack of the inspectors. And now is the time when they got the inspectors on island to sort of take advantage of it here for something that, you know, literally, I've heard politicians talk about for generations, you know. Oh, my God, I can think and remember hearing this one in the 70s if I really try really hard, you know, the idea of a slaughterhouse. So, I have to say that various politicians over those last couple of generations have sort of highlighted the prospect of a slaughterhouse, while neatly sidestepping the practical problems of doing it, which was the absence of actually on-island USDA inspectors, which was always came back down to that, no matter how this was taken a look at. But now that that problem has been resolved, I think it's important to seize on this opportunity to actually make this a reality. And it's, I'm greatly comforted by the fact that, Chelsea, you're already on the case, and you've already well thought this one out. So this is just now pushing for the final few steps to kind of make this happen here. So I'm hopeful that your efforts will prove fruitful, and then maybe we'll see a mobile slaughterhouse by sometime next year. You know, cross fingers and pray to the fiscal gods that that the funding will will come in, you know. But in any event, you know, this is kind of like an exciting period for you, Chelsea. That's not only you are breaking new ground with the fine work of your conservation officers, the long held dream of a slaughterhouse is now within a grasp. You know, we just have to do the hard work on it. You know, less speechifying and more hard work, I think, is what's called for in this situation here. But also, though, this is one of your responsibilities, and maybe he's dismissed Jay Gutierrez too earlier for this one, is for offshore natural resources, and particularly our coral reefs. And there is a great deal of activity in Gauchi, a number of financing mechanisms, including reef insurance, to support our coral reefs. Whitney Hewitt, the Coral Reef Resiliency Coordinator, who reports to you as Guam's representative to the U.S. Coral Reef Task Force, as her and her colleagues have done a dynamite job of pulling together an actual island-wide coral reef restoration plan, which they hope to finalize in August. And I hope to have you and Whitney on some future program to go into that when they finalize the program, the actual plan. A lot of the framework was done by a coral resiliency workshop conducted by the Nature Conservancy, which was supposed to be in person in Honolulu last year, but you know, there was COVID, and then it was done by teleworking, and if not for the issues regarding the COVID-19, you know, we probably would have had it early. Oh my gosh, do we have another caller on the line? Okay, caller, are you there? Caller, are you there?
Good evening, Tyrone. Good evening, Chelsea.
Okay, can you identify yourself?
Yes, my name is Dave.
And, hi, Dave. Dave Duenas. There we go. I didn't, you know, this credit. Dave, you have a question.
How you doing? I love the topic, and I'm thrilled to death about this possibility of a slaughterhouse. I have a question for Chelsea.
Please.
Who is your oversight senator for agriculture?
Senator Clint Ridgell.
Clint Ridgell. Have your agency went in front of the legislature for your budget?
Yes, we have.
Okay. I was thinking, you know, how the community, people like myself, can assist in this. And again, I'm very, very thrilled about the very strong possibility that we will have our first mobile slaughterhouse. It's fantastic. I can just picture it right now, that slaughterhouse coming to my village in Didido, and people say, hey, I got some chickens, I got a pig, can you slaughter it, kill it for me, and pack it up, and you know, it lends itself to sustainability. It also creates possibly revenue for Guam in the future should people get involved in raising cattle, for example.
Yeah. Hey, Dave, you know why we can picture in our mind the idea of a slaughterhouse, a mobile slaughterhouse? Because you've been talking about it for 30 years. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chelsea.
Yeah, you know, I did speak about it with a friend of mine very recently, and it was, I did not know that. I thought it was genuinely a new idea, only to find out, listening to your show, that idea has been around for a few decades.
Oh, my God. I remember party platforms from the 90s I wrote about this, you know. So, you know,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, getting back with Chelsea, I would encourage the listeners out there, if you're listening, to give your oversight chair a call and see if we can increase that budget of yours to include the cost of this mobile slaughterhouse.
Absolutely. I would say, you know, you don't have to stop with Senator Ridgell. Send an email. You can even send the same email and just put all of the senators in it so that they all know that this is something that the community supports. And we didn't stop with thank you. I mean, just listening to you talk, the thing that came to my mind is soon then we get to have fresh meat. We get to have meat that was raised on Guam, eating grass. And then that's what we get to eat and feed our families every night. And we're supporting our local farmers or livestockers, ranchers, who are raising this for us. And it doesn't get any better than that. I mean, processing my own chickens, some of the best chicken I've ever had in my life.
But we also realized that if we wanted to take this commercial, this is a great, the mobile slaughterhouse is a great opportunity to get a family business started. You start off with either 20 heads and then increase to 50 and 100. And then if you have multiple little farms, like just hundreds of little farms around the island raising livestock, and we wanted to take it commercial where they were going to start selling to the restaurants, start selling to the hotels, start selling to the stores, then we started thinking about building the brick-and-mortar structure and what that would look like. And when we had our conversations with the USDA inspectors, we realized we didn't need anything super massive. Even for a brick-and-mortar, they were showing us examples of processing facilities that were built out of already existing warehouses. So then we thought the ideal spot would be Harmon Industrial Park. And then there wouldn't be so much of the not in my backyard because all the smelly stuff happens down there anyway. With the larger warehouse businesses. So this is something that we could have a mobile or the brick and mortar slaughterhouse that when we needed that capacity, we would have that ready in Harmon as a potential site. So we started talking about that.
I'm curious, the mobile slaughterhouse, what's the size? Is it like a tractor trailer type size?
Think of like, it's bigger than when you think of like an ice cream van, and you actually can pull it around on a trailer. So it's enough where that a truck like a Tundra or a Dodge Ram could pull it around. And it was not the size of like a container, a shipping container, smaller than that, smaller than a 20-foot container, but roughly about that size that you just pull around
again,
on a truck.
Yeah, I'm definitely really excited about this possibility, and I'm a positive type thinker guy, and I think it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Congratulations for taking the reins and moving it forward. Thank you.
And Chelsea and Dave, if I may interject, just to sort of remind everybody here, our economy is still recovering from COVID, and the outlook for the tourism economy, which collapsed last year, is not good for tourism globally here. So it's not going to happen going back to normal anytime soon, which means
right.
A lot of it, if we're going to make actual real progress in recovering the economy, is going to be through a diversified strategy, in particular agriculture, as the governor herself has outlined here. So these efforts before we get into discussions about almost pastoral discussions about having fresh meat and small scale farmers here. What we have here is, I think, an important element in helping to bring back Guam's economy, to create more jobs, to replace the ones that were lost and may not come back anytime soon. I just think so. There's a lot more riding on this one beyond some of the important things that were mentioned here. I think it's an important part to give people options for economic growth and options for more private sector employment here. That's real crucial at these important times, particularly as the pool checks are going to run out in September, and we're going to have to really concentrate on job growth once that's done to sustain working families and also to provide needed inputs into our economy until other elements of the military build up perhaps kick in and tourism actually gets back. So, no pressure, Chelsea.
Fantastic. I thank you both, Tyrone, taking my call. And Chelsea, keep up the great work you're doing over there, Dad.
And thank you, Dave. Thank you so much for calling in. So,
Esta.
Anyway, Chelsea, so we're headed here for the last roughly 4 minutes of the program. By the way, I touch on another subject. You have a U.S. DOI Technical Assistance Program grant application pending to deal with the stray dog situation, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Okay. So before the people ask about that one as well, you're also on top of that one and working for solutions and being creative funding solutions for that issue. But that's for another program. But for the last 3.5 minutes of it here, I'll turn the mic over to you to mention something that you haven't had a chance to get in because I talk too much. So
we have so much going on. We swore in our forestry aides and foresters. They were existing employees. They've been fighting fires
for decades. They became certified in conducting criminal arson wildland investigations. And so we wanted to swear them in as peace officers and are working with DOA on getting them certified as such, because they've been doing that work for years and putting their lives on the line to fight fires and prevent fires and to now conduct investigations about them. So it's only right and just that we recognize them as such. We're working with DETA in our agricultural development section to restore the breeding station that's up in, Jigo. It's definitely Jigo. Breeding station where we had agricultural technicians working on breeding and improving the quality of the swine stock on Guam, and also the working on chickens, and there's even room for cattle there. And we want to bring that back and work with 4-H on teaching that livestock industry and animal husbandry to youth who are engaging in agriculture, and exposing them to the wide breadth of agriculture, not just plants and vegetables and fruits, but the livestock component of it too. So we've had a lot going on.
Okay, and certainly you sort of have, quite obviously you have a lot on your plate, and kudos to you for showcasing the fine work of your conservation officers. You know, this is, I think it's very important that we also keep in mind people in the front lines, particularly the front lines of that doesn't always get the notice, you know, because there's not enough blood involved or there's not an interesting enough car accident. But it's sort of out there, and again, kudos to your operation for highlighting the fine work of your conservation officers. And I'll keep in touch to tell you when your correction officers get their brand new patrol vehicle, hopefully by next week. Okay.
Absolutely.
Anyway, thank you, my friend, for joining us on the Data Hub. I'll catch up with you on a later meeting and maybe a later program as we circle around to the many, many things that you're involved as Director of Agriculture. Thanks,
well,
Joseph.
Thank you so much, Justin Winyabrek.
Okay, great. That's Justin Winyabrek, Director of the Department of Agriculture. We're heading towards the 7 o'clock CBS Radio News and future programs. We'll have GRTA General Manager Selva Bauta, and also personnel from the Guam Coastal Management Program for the Bureau of Statistics and Plans. A podcast of tonight's proceedings will be posted on K57.com over the next few days, and a link to it will be posted on the Bureau's three social media pages, one for the Bureau itself, one for the Coral Reef Initiative, and one for the Guam Coastal Management Program. We head on the top of the news, and I will see you all next Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. for another edition of the Data Hub. See you all next week.